Napoli with a high fly ball. Deep right. Back goes Batista on the track toward the wall. Jumps. Ball kicks off his glove. Bangs up against the wall. Retrieved by Pilar. In to score is Santana. And in sliding with an RBI double is Mike Napoli.
Bauer, that finger is bleeding. And again, you just wonder, if he starts getting blood on the baseball, he's in trouble because the umpires won't let him go. And that thing is bleeding badly. Standing and roaring as Trevor Bauer has to leave the game. Pretty embarrassing for what is going on up here for a place that you used to come here and think, my goodness, this is a classy bunch. There goes, pinch hit on the ground, right to the second base bag. Lindor has it, steps, throws, got him! Lindor bobbled it, but he was right at the bag at second, and he was down on one knee on that hot smash.
Swung on, and there's a high fly ball. This one's hit to deep left center, way back. Home run, Napoli! Drive in front, 2-1.
Kipnis with a drive, headed deep right field, gone! And the Indians are back on top. Down low, there goes Napoli. Martin delayed, then through to second, not in time, and Napoli does it again. Swung at line drive, base hit up the alley in right center. Napoli is coming home to score. How about that? And Jose Ramirez gets his first hit of the championship series, and the Indians lead it 4-2. Swung on line drive to left field. Chris coming on, dives. He made the catch! He made the catch! If he doesn't make that catch and the ball gets by him, the Blue Jays tie the game. What a play by Coco.
And no one manipulates a bullpen better than Terry Francona.
Slider, check swing, he went around. Miller gets another strikeout. Swing and a miss. Struck him out on the slider.
And one of the great postseason stories of all time unfolding here tonight in Toronto with what this Indians pitching staff is about to accomplish. The pitch.
Swung on, bank, back up the middle, behind second, backhanded by Kipnis, throw to first, ball game! He got him on a great play, ranging far to his right with a backhand in back of second and a tremendous throw to first. And the Indians have beaten the Blue Jays again in the most improbable scenario you've ever envisioned in postseason play.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
What an unbelievable night of watching baseball last night, and we have got an amazing opportunity to talk all about it over the course of the next 2 hours right here on the Extravaganza on Toledo Sports Leader. We are ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks so much for joining us. Hope you're having an outstanding day. Hey, Cushlin. That team that ended up winning the American League Central, going away by 8 games, but that we thought was sunk when it came time for the postseason because of their pitching rotation, because of the injuries to Salazar and to Carrasco, and of course in the offensive side of things to Michael Brantley and to Yan Gomes. That team that we thought was going to have a short stay thanks to all of the injuries is 1 game away from the World Bleeping Series. Can you even imagine that?
I could have imagined it, considering if they were fully healthy and things like that. We could have easily probably written, postseason preview.
But they're not.
But they're not. So,
and that's why they shouldn't be here.
They shouldn't.
It's not possible.
And the fact that they still haven't lost a game, that they are 6-0 overall between their games against the Red Sox and Blue Jays, and how they've gone about doing this is unbelievable. It really is.
It's not just improbable. I mean, really, it's impossible. We're watching an impossible thing happen. And you know what? Announcers, by their very nature, I think we would all agree, no matter who they are. And by the way, that was thanks to the Indians Radio Network for those cuts. Announcers, generally speaking, can be given to hyperbole and sometimes overstate things and over-dramatize the moment. I think we all acknowledge that. I've done play-by-play. You still do play-by-play on Friday nights. We can all kind of get there from time to time, and especially the best among us. And when you're at the top level like that, you can certainly do that. But I don't think it's an overstatement. What you just heard in those cuts at the broadcast, as we talk American League Championship Series baseball to get the day started here on this Tuesday afternoon edition. I don't think it was an overstatement when he said, we are watching one of the most amazing runs, and I can't remember exactly what word he used, or historic runs. No, because it wouldn't be historic, because he said, in baseball history. What we are watching right now is just simply one of the most amazing stories in the postseason in baseball history. And I'm paraphrasing it, obviously. I didn't memorize exactly what he said, but as I heard it, I thought he's right. I mean, show me, and now I don't even think even Elias would have stats on something like this. You don't track injuries to guys who are considered the number two and the number three starters on your in your on your starting rotation. But I would be very, very surprised to see too many other, if any other, pennant winners, you know, league championship winners, whether or not they win the World Series or not, and of course they still have to get there. They got to win one more time. But a pennant winner to lose two of their top three starters in one season, especially late in the season where they can't contribute even a little bit, even out of relief, and then to have the guy who is elevated from the fourth spot into one of the top three spots in your rotation in the playoffs slice his finger up and be unable to go beyond two-thirds of an inning. So three of your top four pitchers are out and unavailable. And for them to win, you know, six straight playoff games under those circumstances and be one game away from the World Series, I would be highly skeptical that that kind of a thing has ever really happened before. I don't think it's hyperbole to say we might be watching one of the most unbelievable, amazing, incredible postseason runs that anybody has really ever seen based on all of those circumstances being, you know, being considered.
Yeah, and unless those Elias guys do it, you know, do it for me, I could probably find the information for that, but you're going to have to give me about an hour or two to thumb through literally every World Series that's been played for over a century.
Then, how would you do that? I don't think you could do that.
No, yeah.
I don't think it's possible. I don't think even Elias could do that. Because
exactly.
You'd be trying to look up injuries, which they don't track at Elias. You'd be trying to then look up injuries to guys who are considered their number two or their number three star,
right?
Which is not something that is, you know, easily verifiable.
And exactly, especially the farther back in the past you go, I'm really sure, you know,
there's
the 1915 White Sox did not really keep an injury log the way we do now.
Right, and really even in the, you know, let's say in the last 50 years, let's
sure.
just, you know, go back to the more modern times to say like 1960 or so, you're not going to have the reference to the number two starter. You know, the number three starter, the slotting that they have today. Yeah, everybody knew who their ace was, sure. But to say that this was the two and this was the three and this would be the way you'd set up your rotation and
sure.
so on and so forth, I don't know that that was ever tracked the way we'd be talking about this now the way we do today. And for three of their four top pitchers to be out. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know if Bauer's going to pitch again. I don't have, as you watch.
Not in this series. I think best case is sometime in game three or four in the World Series, and that's best case.
I don't
case.
Even think that, Jim. I mean,
that's why I'm emphasizing best
that,
case.
If you saw that finger of his pouring blood out of it like it's a spigot outside, like somebody left the hose on, or not the hose, but just the, you know, the side spigot.
Yeah.
And somebody left it on, not all the way, but just enough to be dripping. A steady drip, but dripping. I mean, dude would have bled out after about five innings if that was unchecked. Maybe not even that long. Dude would have just bled out. And I know that sounds graphic, and that sounds like overstatement and melodramatic and hyperbole, but seriously, that dude, it wasn't just like a couple of blood drops on his finger that he had to keep blind.
Right.
He had to stanch the flow of blood. He had to stem the tide. There was no way. I mean, if you heard Terry Francona after the game talking about what he saw when he went out there, obviously when John Gibbons went out there at first to say, hey, you know, to the umpires, you know, we got to know here, you know, is he putting anything on that ball? Because he's got some, you know, some natural body fluid on the ball, you know, that could affect things here. There's a foreign substance on the ball. Can you please check on that? Which, of course, is the right thing to do for John Gibbons. And for the umpires to go out there and say, yeah, and then here comes Tito. Tito Francona said, it was all over the rubber. It was all over the dirt. And if you looked at his blue jersey, if that jersey had been white or gray, if they had been wearing road grays or something like that, it would have been, I mean, seriously, it would have looked like it was a horror movie. He would have looked like he just met up with Freddy Krueger. Because there was that much blood flowing. So the way Terry described it, it's a mess. And I can't see, even if they sweep, and then they still have to wait to see what happens in a 1-1 series in the National League. I don't know when the World Series would actually get underway.
October 25th.
It's official, so no matter what.
Oh, that's been official. That,
okay.
Yes.
So, yeah, so we're talking 7 days.
Yeah,
right?
One week from today is game one. which would be at the host at the AL Park, of course.
Those 10 stitches, did you look closely at that, not just on TV, but there's pictures on the net, on the internet?
No, those I haven't looked at as closely. No.
Those stitches, now I'm not a doctor and I'm not trying to play one. Those don't look just superficial. It looks like that got down into the blades that cut him up from that drone.
Uh-huh.
Got down into the meat of that pinky finger. It looks like some of those are internal stitches. That means we're not just talking about, you know, a couple of days and the stitches, you know, can be removed and it's healing up and everything else. That looks like it's something that's going to be a problem for a while. It looks to me, and again, not being a doctor, I'm just being a guy. I'm just the same as you and everybody else. I'm just being a guy as I look at it. If it was my kid, I'd be thinking that dude isn't going to be able to use that hand for a couple of weeks. That's my thought. And when I say a couple of weeks, I mean literally a two-week period based on the stitches and how it looks and how the cut looks and, you know, just that mangled finger. And it's not easy to look at, by the way. It's really kind of disgusting.
And in some ways, during the game last night when he tried to go out there and pitch, is some of the closest we've seen to it. There really weren't a lot of pictures of it or anything before the game or anything.
No. Well, there were. If you looked on Twitter and if you looked on a few other places, you can find it. That's the reason. That's how I knew what it looked like. Not just from there, but I looked before the game to see what it looked like because I found out that they were on the web. And again, it just doesn't look like it's superficial. It looks like it was a pretty mangled thing. And I don't think he's going to be able to go. So anyway, this is a long way of saying something very simple, that what they're doing is not only improbable, it's probably impossible. And yet here they are. They've done it. They're 6-0 in the playoffs. And after sweeping the Red Sox and now being on the verge with Corey Kluber going on this afternoon in about a little less than an hour for game number 4, they could sweep the Blue Jays. And I tweeted last night, watching them go 3-0 and 3-0 in the first two series thus far, I found myself thinking of Moses Malone, and I wondered if anybody else had. And I don't think too many other people understood my reference there. But Moses Malone, the late, great Hall of Fame center way back in 1983 with the Philadelphia 76ers, made a prediction on the way into the playoffs when somebody asked him, because that was the year the Sixers were pushing and running up towards 70 wins, something obviously we only saw the Bulls and now the Warriors reach in NBA history. But back in 1983, they were just that good, and he was asked his prediction going into the playoffs. And for those who are old enough to remember that, his response to the media was, fo, fo, fo. Fo, fo, fo. It sounds like something that the Green Giant says, right? Fee, fi, fo, fum. No. He said fo, fo, fo. F-O, 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 which was his way of saying 4-4-4.
Because there were only three best-of-seven rounds at the time.
He was predicting four-game sweeps in the first round, in the conference championship round, and in the NBA Finals. And as it turned out, it was 4-5-4. Because they did lose a game in the conference finals to the Milwaukee Bucks. But they did sweep in the first round, and they did sweep the Lakers in the NBA Finals. So it turned out to be 4-5-4. All I know, it was impossible to predict that the Indians would beat the Red Sox, let alone sweep them. It was impossible to predict that they would be having this kind of success against that massive, free-swinging, home-run-clubbing Toronto Blue Jays lead with only one of your top four starters actually able to pitch. They were in a situation where yesterday, if Bauer had been able to give them any length at all and they were able to avoid making yesterday the bullpen day, they were in a position where they were going to start 24-year-old Ryan Merritt, who in today's game, who is who pitched most of the season at AAA down in Columbus and only had, what, I think three or four appearances with the Indians all season long.
Three or four appearances. He had one start. It was the, I think, last day of the season on the 30th. Or the Friday. It was in that last series.
Against the Kansas City Royals, and he went five innings and gave them a quality start.
Yes, he did.
But I think he had a couple of other appearances at various points in time. But at any rate, that's where they were. I mean, they're talking about AAA pitchers, and they brought him in just obviously because of the Bauer injury, rather than starting Clevinger. So they were going to go with him today, and then if need be in Game 5, Corey Kluber on his regular rest. But because, and obviously today, it would have been Merritt and or Clevinger and whatever other host of relievers they needed to use. And instead of having to do that now, they will go with Corey Kluber to try to close the entire thing out since they used seven pitchers yesterday. Bauer for his two-thirds and then six relievers. all of whom went some variation of one inning to one and a third to one and two-thirds innings in just shutting down the Toronto Blue Jays, one reliever at a time. Nobody threw more than 28 pitches all the way down. And Terry Francona's masterful handling of the bullpen. Mike Greenberg said this morning that Francona, two-time champion, has long been one of the great managers in the game. But Greenberg on Mike and Mike this morning, that you hear each and every weekday right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket, by the way, Greenberg said this morning as I listened to him that this was Terry Francona's finest managing hour. His ability to react to something he couldn't even have predicted. And that's what he said. That's what he said after the game when asked about the situation and how he had to use those relievers. He was asked about those, you know, the way everybody performed, and he said, "We thought we prepared for just about everything, but I don't think we prepared for him to not be able to get out of the first inning, that the blood flow would start that fast, and we would have to go and do what we did." And rather than be rattled by it, he pushed every single button, and every time he did, it was the right one. It's like he's borderline mystical, soothsayer. Has a crystal ball, can see every single step of the way before that step has to be taken. Even going to the closer, Cody Allen, in the seventh inning as opposed to the ninth inning, and Andrew Miller, who had gone as early in this playoff series in the fifth inning, holding him to the ninth inning, working around Shaw and Otero and who else got an inning?
McAllister, Manship.
Finding not just the right arms, but the right arms at the right time.
Bingo.
To cross up the Blue Jays.
You know,
just a master stroke that Greeny said, and I find it hard to disagree, might have been Francona's most masterful managing job yet.
Yeah, and to me, the best flashpoint example of that is the very first reliever that came in immediately after, you know, Bauer was bleeding and had to be removed from the game. And for those who hadn't understood, no, it's not technically that he was bleeding all over the place and hurt is why he had to be. He was technically removed. I just like to throw this out. I'm sure some have read it probably by now. He was technically thrown out on the rule about basically defacing the ball because the blood would get over all over the ball, and you can't have that. So that's technically why he had to be removed if you want to get rule book technical. Anyway, Otero, think about this. He's one of those four main shutdown guys. We all know Miller and Allen, and then there's Shaw. The fourth one this season has been Otero, and he's been outstanding. And they brought
him
in.
Among the major league leaders in ERA.
Exactly. And it's because of what he's done, not necessarily in that Andrew Miller kind of situation, but he was brought on. Bauer walked two in that first inning, partly, I imagine, because, gee, I don't know, one of his fingers is about to fall off. There's two on with two out, and still you're in the meat of the order. You can't really go to a McAllister and say, start the bridge of giving me long relief in that older set. You had to go with somebody who, okay, it may say it's first inning, but this is like, hey, we're bringing you into a jam in the seventh. And that, so right there, before you get to any of the other moves last night, I thought that was one of the most interesting, and it kind of exemplifies what we're talking about with what Francona's doing here.
Yeah, no question about it. It's you know, I mean, let's hear from Terry Francona himself a little bit after the game last night. Now, I know they're getting ready. He's already made pregame comments here before game number four, which is going to start at 4:08 this afternoon. But here's what he had to say about that bullpen job. And again, in typical, very humble Terry Francona fashion, he's not talking about his decisions and how he did this thing, but about the performance that he got from those guys.
Well, that wasn't the way we drew it up. The first thing I saw was blood on the rubber. I figured that wasn't a real good sign that things were going well. I mean, it was bleeding pretty good. The weird thing, there was only one little spot that opened, but, man, it was coming out a lot. I get it. I mean, shoot, it was only a matter of time till everybody saw it. It was bleeding pretty bad. I admit that's a little bit of a unique way to win a playoff game. The alternative is to lose. I don't think anybody wants to do that. But about our bullpen, that's one of the most amazing jobs I've ever seen, starting with Otero to Manship to McAllister to Shaw. If anybody has a hiccup, we probably lose. And they all made pitches and against some really good hitters.
It's a great point that he made. If any one of those guys has a hiccup, if any one of them doesn't get their job done, they probably lose. Because then it's going to throw off everything that he was planning to do. He'd have to bring somebody in to get out of an inning in which somebody got the hiccup, if you will, which affects the next inning and the one after that and the one after that. So for everybody to get out there and do their job the way that they did yesterday in game number three, it's just a look. look, we're in Toledo, Ohio. This is a phenomenal sports town for so many reasons. And one of the reasons is it's such an intelligent sports town because we're surrounded by professional and college sports literally to all sides. You know, Cleveland to the east of us, Detroit to the north of us, and of course, Ohio State and Michigan and so on and so forth. And it's really just a wonderful place. And I know, of course, being the home of the Toledo Mud Hens, there's probably a ton more Tigers fans than there are Indians here. But I know that Toledo sports fans and just sports fans, period, whether your loyalties lie with the Tigers or not, really appreciate an underdog story. And I think as American sports fans, we do. We love an underdog. And it doesn't matter who it is. Even if it's somebody we really don't like a lot, we like underdog stories. And for that team out there in Cleveland to be doing what they're doing is just a very special thing to see, and I hope people can appreciate how impossible this would be. Now, if you need to do this, then you pick who's the best all-around hitter in the Tigers lineup. Probably Miguel Cabrera. Now, this is not to put Michael Brantley on Cabrera's level. He's not. But he's the Indians' best all-around hitter. Silver Slugger Award winner and MVP candidate last year, right? Last year. Gone out of the lineup for all but 11 games. Now remove the Tigers' second, third, and fourth starters from their rotation. The top two, the second and third, from the rotation for the vast majority of the season. Because Salazar was on the DL two different times, and of course, missed the stretch run of the season.
Right.
All of September and part of August. Carrasco was out for a month earlier in the season, and then the last month of the season as well. So take those guys out and now try to go into the playoffs with your number one, your ace, and we'll call it Verlander. You don't get to use Fulmer. You don't get to use, however this turned out at the end of the season as far as, Zimmerman was already gone. But let's just say your best pitchers, were, say, Zimmerman and Fulmer, and who would you put in the fourth spot?
And Matt Boyd. Probably Matt Boyd at this point.
Okay. So we'll put Boyd in like the Bauer role. And those three guys are not available to you in the postseason. And you're supposed to win with V, Verlander, JV, and then, I don't know, Anibal Sanchez and who else?
Yeah, Anibal Sanchez would be in the Josh Tomlin role, and due to the injuries, the Ryan Merritt role would be played by Buck Farmer.
So think about this now. And then, Miggy not hitting. Miggy not in the offense.
Yeah, and Miggy not in the offense.
Okay. And again, that's a little bit of an odd thing because he's so much better than almost everybody else. Almost, he's a Hall of Fame talent. But that's the role that Brantley played, as the number three or four hitter in the Indians lineup, and he's not there. So imagine that, and now imagine your Tigers being one game away from the World Series, not having lost a game in the postseason, 3-0 and 3-0. Then you'll maybe appreciate a little bit more what guys like me and Kush and people who are loyalists to that team are seeing right now. You don't have to be a fan of that team to appreciate what you are seeing. And what we're seeing is really something, I don't know, Hamilton, I don't think, overstated that in that radio call, that is really, really unique in baseball history. And then, of course, we haven't even mentioned him other than the fact that he was bleeding like his finger was a faucet that had been left turned on. Trevor Bauer on his performance in the two-thirds of an inning and the 21 pitches he threw, and having to leave after that finger would just not stop flowing.
No, it felt good. Like, warming up, felt good. Stuff was good. I was locating everything. Pinky wasn't a problem. Didn't bleed at all, which was, the main concern. Felt like I executed pretty well, threw a lot of close pitches. Struggled with my command of my curveball a little bit, but I felt like I was starting to find it. And then, obviously, it started bleeding on me. So I would have liked to stay in the game, but obviously with that amount of blood, that's... Can't do that.
Is it okay to be mad at Trevor Bauer? I was mad, and I expressed it on Twitter, and a lot of other people did too, but a lot of other people came to his defense and said, leave him alone. This is not fair. You can't kick a man when he's down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is it okay to be mad at Trevor Bauer for putting himself in that position after seeing Carrasco and Salazar already go down and knowing how important he was to this rotation? We're going to ask that question to Matt Lodi, who's covering the series and the Indians in the postseason for the Northeast Ohio, the NEO Sports Insiders.com and for the Associated Press out there in Northeast Ohio. So we'll talk to him right after we get a timeout here in a sports center. And we'll do that after I tell you about the Buckeye store and more, the College and Pro Superstore. Again, it's one of the great things about being in Northwest Ohio is access to a store like the Buckeye store and more in Sylvania. Because if you are a Buckeyes fan, it's your nirvana. But if you're a Michigan fan, my God, you love it too, even though the word Buckeye is in the name because of the huge Michigan fan zone inside the Buckeye store and more. As well as the fan zones for the Fighting Irish, Michigan State Spartans, Toledo Rockets, BG Falcons, and the Detroit Tigers, as mentioned as well. That's the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore. 10% store-wide savings continues. Hundreds of new Nike products in stock and hundreds of new products arriving every single day at the largest store in Ohio dedicated primarily to Buckeye gear. Get to the Buckeye Store and More at 5700 Monroe Street in Sylvania, right between Ralphie's and Dave's. Big inflatable Brutus is on the roof waving you in to the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore. More American League Championship Series conversation to come. Would you be mad if you were a teammate of Trevor Bauer or a fan of the Indians over this whole thing? We would love your thoughts, too, at 866-240-1065.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Well, that wasn't the way we drew it up. First thing I saw was blood on the rubber. I figured that wasn't a real good sign that things were going well. I mean, it was bleeding pretty good. The weird thing, there was only one little spot that opened, but, man, it was coming out a lot. I get it. I mean, shoot, it was only a matter of time till everybody saw it. It was bleeding pretty bad. I admit that's a little bit of a unique way to win a playoff game. The alternative is to lose. I don't think anybody wants to do that. But about our bullpen, that's one of the most amazing jobs I've ever seen, starting with Otero to Manship to McAllister to Shaw. If anybody has a hiccup, we probably lose. And they all made pitches and against some really good hitters.
No question about it. It was an unbelievable performance, not only by each and every one of the relievers that Terry Francona mentioned, but by the manager himself for that masterful handling of an impossible situation dealing with the bloody finger of Trevor Bauer. Joining us now for some more American League Championship Series coverage right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, the owner and editor of Northeast Ohio Sport, NEO, sportsinsiders.com. Also reports for the AP radio version in Northeast Ohio. Matt Lodi joining us. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Hey, Bob. Good afternoon.
Good to have you. Thank you so much. What did you think when Trevor Bauer took the mound? Did you have in any of your scenarios, any more than Terry Francona did, that a possibility that he would not even last an inning? Did you think he would at least get into two or three or give them something before the blood became a problem?
Yeah, I thought at least a couple of innings. And obviously I think that was the Indians' sort of worst-case scenario. I know Jason Kipnis in the interview after the game on TBS said that, you know, he knew that there was a possibility that this may happen. And I'm sure the Indians trainers had to be aware of it, but I think that was the worst case scenario, what happened last night. But obviously, as everything in this playoffs has gone the way of the Indians, it actually worked out for the better, for Trevor Bauer and for this organization. I was a little taken aback by some of the criticisms, and there was one sports writer in this market who kind of blasted Bauer, saying that, you know, he's a child, that, you know, you can't put your team in that position. And I take exception to that because, you know, at first everybody's upset when they hear about what happened and they hear about how it happened and everything else. But listen, these guys are human beings. You cannot put them in a bubble. You cannot tell them to not do their hobbies. And it's not like, as I was telling somebody earlier today, it's not like that Trevor Bauer went snowboarding for the first time in his life and broke his leg. He was doing something that he evidently practices and does a lot. You know, this is not, this wasn't anything foreign to him. Yeah, right. But, you know, I mean, this was just a freak accident. You know, he might as well have been cutting a slice of bread or, you know, cutting a steak or whatever, if you will. And that's how this happened. So I thought that, you know, the scenario of it happening certainly was unfortunate, but I think the Indians handled it great. And I think that the organization has been very lucky in that this bullpen has been so dominant throughout the first five or six games now here of the postseason that they were able to get away last night with having to throw, what is it, eight and a third worth of shutout ball or two-run ball, I guess, if you will. And they're able to get out of that thing last night with a victory and able now to turn it over to Corey Kluber today with a chance to wrap this thing up in really unbelievably historically quick fashion.
Well, I'll tell you what. I might make you mad then, because I am one who is also a little bit upset with Trevor Bauer in this situation. In fact, I tweeted last night as he walked off the mound. And by the way, for everybody, this just one, there's a lot of layers to this, Matt, and I'm sure you realize. Everybody's saying, oh, what a bunch of classy people up there in Toronto cheering him as he walks off the mound injured. You know, they're cheering somebody's injury and the fact that he's bleeding. What did you want them to do? I mean, the opposing team that is leading you 2-0 in this series just got put into a horrible situation. Their starter has got to leave the game before the first inning is up. They've got to go into their bullpen now. That's cheerworthy. They got to be excited as heck about that. Doesn't mean they want the guy to bleed to death. They're cheering because it's a good move for their team that the Indians are in trouble right now. I would expect nothing less from Progressive Field or from Comerica Park if the opposing team's pitcher is getting kicked out, or not kicked out, but, you know, being removed for whatever the
having to leave the game
are in the first inning. Don't blame the Toronto fans for that. I blame them for a lot of things, especially in that Eastern Conference Finals. Some of the stuff that was going on with some of the chants they were directing at the Cavaliers. But you know what? This is just, they're cheering the situation. They're watching the starter leave, and that means that's good for us. We're going to get into their bullpen early. They can't be this good for 8 1/3 innings. Sure enough, they were. But at the time, they didn't know that. But to the point about Bauer, and I actually just tweeted this from our Twitter feed right here at ESPN 106.5, The Ticket, asking a question, a poll question. Is it okay for Indians fans to be mad at Trevor Bauer for putting his team in this situation? And the choices on the little poll question that I put up there on Twitter are no, give the guy a break. Yes, his carelessness hurts his team. Or C, ask me after it's over, and we'll see if we can survive it or not. Then we'll tell. But, Matt, last night during as he walked off the mound to all of those cheers, here's what I tweeted. I don't know, maybe you saw it, maybe you didn't. But I tweeted, already down two starters, 2 days away from the biggest start of my life. I think I'll play with some sharp propeller blades. Hashtag Bauer. That was the extent of my criticism. Because I did find it to be just completely unnecessarily putting his team in a very bad spot. You're already down two starters, and that's a pretty dangerous thing. He wasn't slicing a sandwich. You know, he was playing with sharp propeller blades on a drone. And if you look at that finger, by the way, it must have turned on or something, because it wasn't just like a quick slice. If you look at that looks deep. It looks like it's down into the meat of the finger. And guess what, Matt Lodi? I said this to Cushlin a few minutes ago. I have fear, being the non-doctor that I am, so this means nothing to anybody. But as I look at that finger and I watched it bleed as porously as it did last night, I don't think it's something that's fixed in a week by the time the World Series starts on October 25th. I don't think it's fixed in a week. I think it's potentially something that could keep him from pitching even in the World Series. 10 stitches, not just superficial ones, but deep into the meat of his finger, which is what it looks like to me as a non-doctor. Honestly, Matt, he may have just pitched himself out of the World Series, or I'm sorry, messed around and gotten himself kicked out of the possible World Series.
Well, I don't know about that, Bob. I can't, you know, and I know you can't either. We don't know that. You know, we don't know where the extent of this injury is going to go, because, in my opinion, the only devil's advocate back to you on that is I don't think the Indians would have put him out there as quickly as they did if they felt that, you know, he was going to do more damage to it, or if they really felt that he was going to not be able to at least give them a couple of innings. I think, as I said earlier, that last night would be ultimate worst-case scenario, that he was only able to go, what was it, two-thirds of an inning. So, to me,
for one game, that was the worst-case scenario for that game. To me, the worst-case scenario is now we find out the truth, now that we know. He can't put pressure on it without it just tearing open and bleeding like crazy. The real worst-case scenario for me, Matt, is that his season is done, that he cannot help this team in the potential World Series that awaits.
And I can't tell you that that's not a possibility. That could be the case. But, again, going back to what I said earlier, I mean, if things play out as they may, let's just say for argument's sake they win today, or even if they don't win today and they win tomorrow, Bauer's going to have, and as I figured it out earlier, roughly 10 days to get this finger right, repaired, healed, whatever the term may be that he needs to get it, you know, obviously healed is the word I think you want to use in this scenario. And 10 days is a pretty good amount of time, because if you figure it out, if the Indians win this thing today, Kluber goes game one against either the Dodgers or the Cubs at Progressive Field next Tuesday. Tomlin goes the following night on Wednesday. the day off is Thursday. He would, you know, technically speaking, Bauer could maybe not have to pitch again in a meaningful game until Friday or Saturday, whether it be in Chicago or in Los Angeles. So that's a healthy amount of time. I mean, that's about the same amount of time that it took Corey Kluber to get his quad healed up, which you never knew how that was going to go. And I know this is a totally different situation because you're talking a wound more or less more than you are a muscle injury.
That would worry me, Matt, is that for those 10 days, he cannot throw. He cannot throw.
True.
He cannot long toss. Yeah. He cannot do his bullpens. He cannot do whatever it takes to get yourself ready in between a long layoff. He's going to have to keep that thing away from a baseball. Otherwise, as we see when he throws a baseball, now that we have physical living proof last night on live TV, that throwing the baseball tears those stitches open. So that's the problem here if he sits with it for 10 days. Even if he does come back into a potential Game 3 situation in the World Series, he just may not be ready to go.
Yeah, and it could be Game 4 because now it appears, at least from what I'm reading and everything that I've heard, that Danny Salazar threw a very strong simulated game. I believe it was yesterday or the day before. You never know. If Danny can go Game 3, you may not have to pitch Trevor until a possible Game 4. And
yeah,
again,
but
that
I don't even think
Saturday.
They're considering that. You've heard more than I have, I thought the Salazar thing, that if he is able to help in the postseason at all, it would only be out of the pen for an inning or two. To come in there and just flame where he only has to throw two pitches. I didn't
Correct.
Think they were even considering him as a potential starter.
Saying they are. I'm just saying that, we didn't ever have to. I mean, could you have ever believed back in, well, we discussed this in June and July and in August, could you have ever possibly considered a scenario where Ryan Merritt would have to pitch a Game 5 in this series? I mean, things have changed so dramatically, and obviously we know if there's one pitcher on this roster we know it isn't going to throw, it's Carlos Carrasco. But everybody else, I mean, all bets are off per se in terms of, how they're going to try to manipulate this in order to get 9 innings out of these guys. I don't really know any other scenario other than that right now. But the fact that they're going to try to do whatever they can just like they did last night. I mean, you could see a Zach McAllister like you did last night, a Jeff Manship, even a Cody Anderson. Whatever Terry and Mickey Callaway have to do in order to get 9 innings, they're going to do it. And I think that the one good thing, as I said earlier, that you could possibly potentially see in the World Series is you want to be able to have Corey Kluber pitch 3 times. And that's, if they can get this thing done today, or even if they can get it done tomorrow, again, you want to get it done today because you're throwing Kluber today. You want to be able to have Corey Kluber rather have a full week of rest and be able to go Tuesday night at Progressive Field. And I'll take my chances with Corey Kluber, Josh Tomlin right now, and a bunch of bullpen guys than I would against any other scenario, because that could be the one the Indians have to face here if things continue to play out. I certainly think that they're happy about the situation they're in. I don't think they're going to complain about how things played out last night, given that, a lot of people felt the minute Trevor Bauer left that game that this team was in trouble. And maybe at that point the series would be in trouble because you knew that you had Corey today, but then you don't know, Ryan Merritt tomorrow. You have no idea what you're going to get out of him. He did throw 5 good innings in Kansas City in a game they had to have late in the season. But really, Bob, as you don't know what you were going to get out of that kid in the postseason. And you were hoping for the best, but preparing for the worst again, if you will.
Yeah. We're talking to Matt Lodi of the Northeast Ohio. I keep saying Northeast Ohio. NEO.
NEO.
Insiders. NEO. You got to just do the abbreviation. NEO, sportsinsiders.com, and the Associated Press in Cleveland. Kurt Schilling, who, of course, is so notable for the Bloody Sock World Series performance managed by Terry Francona. A lot of people were talking about that last night and said, man, this is, this is reminiscent of that. And this is what Kurt Schilling tweeted last night. Please don't tweet at me about Bauer. He cost himself a start, likely more, and his teammates and fans blanking around with a drone. Hashtag stupid. So he's kind of feels the same way I did, that it's just that, when you've got so many people relying on you, don't increase the, I'm not saying you have to live your life in a bubble wrap, but don't increase the likelihood that something bad could happen by doing things that are even remotely dangerous. Certainly, if you're going to go give your alligator a bath, don't do it 2 days before the biggest start of your life in case something bad happens, is kind of his feeling there. And I think that's where those people who are, and maybe it's just, of course, we've been conditioned to expect bad things from a team that has been snake bitten for so many years, 68 years since winning a world championship in 1948. You just kind of expect bad things. And so you're just like, please don't increase the likelihood that bad things are going to happen. Matt, Jim Cushman is here alongside. He's got a question.
Sure.
Jimmy.
You know, and I'm thinking about this whole Corey Kluber starting, you know, today. And obviously, you know, it was predicated on the fact that Terry Francona had to use his bullpen, obviously, so heavily, as is obviously documented from yesterday. And that flipped it back around. And so therefore, Matt, we've all kind of been reading this all day today. He's never made a career start, you know, on 3 days rest. There's all that talk about past guys that might have struggled in this situation. What is a reasonable expectation for Corey Kluber in this one today?
Well, I mean, he has struggled in the Rogers Center. There's no question about it. You go back to that game in July when he got, you know, the team actually got pounded, and Corey did 2-17-1 back in that weekend that started with the 19-inning game on Friday. Actually, it started Thursday. They won a game Thursday, but the Friday game is what kind of threw everything out of whack in that four-game setup in Toronto. They ended up having to start Zach McAllister on Saturday of that series, and then Corey, with what everybody thought was going to be good rest, came out on Sunday and just did not pitch well. That was his worst start of the season by far. But I think to answer your question, Jim, I think if you get six innings out of him today, you're thrilled. I really do. And when I say six innings, I mean six innings of hopefully one or two run ball. I mean, if, you know, he comes out today and gives up five in the first inning, you got problems, you know. But certainly, I think if you're the Indians, I think there's a mental thing here today, and I think, of course, the physical thing. The physical is that, yes, he's going on short rest, but the mental thing today, and Corey is the one guy, or Tomlin for that matter, I would want on the mound in this situation, is you have your foot on their throat. Let's just be honest. They are demoralized after last night because I think they all thought, and I talked to, who was it? It was Kevin Pillar or the other day, or and the other kid, the young kid, the catcher, Russell Martin, and they all said that, oh, we come home, it's going to be different. We're going to be able to hit better. It's our fan base, blah, blah, blah. And they didn't do it. You know, they scored two runs off of, again, a bunch of relief pitchers, really, and two-thirds of an inning from Bauer. So, to me, the Indians have such a psychological edge right now that if they could just get five or six out of Corey Kluber today, I think they would be thrilled with that. And, again, I know that they've had to use Andrew Miller five times. I know they've had to use Cody Allen, a bunch of times. But, listen, this is what you do this for. You know, the old adage, you can rest in the off season. This is, you know, and if, again, as I mentioned to Bob earlier, if they can win this game today, you've got a week off. I mean, I think that's a lot of time. You know, some may think it's too much time, but I think that's a great advantage for the Indians if they can wrap this thing up today in Toronto, that you've got all this rest ahead of you, and you're starting the World Series at home, which I think also means a lot. So I think this plays out perfectly for the Indians. Get Kluber five or six, turn it over back again to the pen, and hopefully get out of there with a win, whether it's by hook or by crook. And, you know, some part of me thinks that this game could be 9-8. Some part of me thinks this game could be 3-2 again. But the way this Indians pitching has been so far through three games and really through six games of the postseason, I have nothing to make me believe otherwise that Corey's going to give them a good outing today and the bullpen's going to do what they've done the last six games.
So are you making the call? Indians win it in four?
Yeah, I do. I think Corey's going to give them a good outing, and I think I have no reason to think otherwise. You know, as I wrote an article earlier on the site today, Terry Francona has made some of the greatest decisions in the postseason that I've ever seen anybody make, whether it's going with Bauer in game one over Kluber to give Kluber the extra day, whether it's throwing Andrew Miller out there every possible chance he can get, no matter how we think that the guy might be tired. You know, the Chisenhall decision in game two to bat him against the lefty and David Price, even though he had hit the ball against Price. Everything he's doing right now looks like gold. So I can't possibly bet against the Indians, Bob, unless I see some flaws or I see some cracks. And they're not playing perfect baseball, but they're certainly playing way good enough baseball to get this thing done. And I think finally last night after that game, I think the guys on TBS finally realized that, hey, give the Indians some credit here. You know, I think there's been this, you know, kind of bias towards Boston and Toronto in the first two rounds. But finally, I think Sheffield and Pedro. Yeah, well, and that's what I mean. It's like, you know, all these people blame, you know, circumstances and all stealing signs and everything. How about just giving the Indians some credit for being a good team and having a good bullpen that's been really, really the best in baseball? This is how Kansas City's done it the last 2 years, and I didn't see anybody, you know, discrediting them. I mean, you know, maybe even Kansas City at this point last season and the year before were a lot healthier than the Indians. But, you know, the fact that this team, if they win today, is going to get a week off and be 7-0 in the postseason. I mean, it's almost, as I wrote last night, it's like a Hollywood script that you wouldn't even accept because it's too unbelievable. with all the things that have not gone this team's way in terms of health.
I described it in the first half hour of the show, Matt Lodi, as being impossible. Not improbable, it's impossible, and yet it's happening before our eyes. We are really talking about something that you couldn't really write and sell to a production company.
To a script, to a studio. They wouldn't buy it.
You know, I said before, I don't think Elias has ever tracked injuries, and they certainly haven't tracked injuries to first, second, third, and fourth rotation starters. But I don't know if anybody has ever done what they've done, and that is literally be on the verge of going to the World Series without their second, third, and fourth starters in their pitching rotation. And that's what it would be without Carrasco, Salazar, and Bauer to go to the World Series under those circumstances, as well as being without their best all-around hitter for the entire season, Michael Brantley.
I was just going to say, don't forget about Brantley.
Forget
about the catcher
position.
Front
him up against
go ahead, Bob.
Thank you for your analysis. We'll keep checking out the work on neosportsinsiders.com. We appreciate it. Enjoy the game today.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it.
You got it. Hey, before we get the top of the hour Sports Center here, let's get you into high school football mode. We've got another four-pack of tickets to see the final St. Francis home game at the Glass Bowl this season, a four-pack for the finale Friday night against Fremont Ross. If you would like to go and see that high school football matchup between St. Francis and Fremont Ross, just be the fifth caller at 866-240-1065 right now, 866-240-1065, and we'll send you to some high school football from your friends right here at the ticket. Hour two coming up.
Napoli with a high fly ball, deep right, back goes Batista on the track toward the wall, jumps, ball kicks off his glove, bangs up against the wall, retrieved by Pilar, in to score is Santana, and in sliding with an RBI double is Mike Napoli. Bauer, that finger is bleeding, and again, you just wonder, if he starts getting blood on the baseball, he's in trouble, because the umpires won't let him go, and that thing is bleeding badly. Standing and roaring as Trevor Bauer has to leave the game. Pretty embarrassing for what is going on up here for a place that you used to come here and think, my goodness, this is a classy bunch. There goes, pitch hit on the ground, right to the second base bag. Lindor has it, steps, throws, got him! Lindor bobbled it, but he was right at the bag at second, and he was down on one knee on that hot smash. Swung on, and there's a high fly ball. This one's hit to deep left center, way back. Home run, Napoli! Drive in front, 2-1. Kipnis with a drive, headed deep right field, gone! And the Indians are back on top. Down low, there goes Napoli. Martin delayed, then through to second, not in time, and Napoli does it again. Swung at late drive, base hit up the alley in right center. Napoli is coming home to score. How about that? And Jose Ramirez gets his first hit of the championship series, and the Indians lead it 4-2. Swung on line drive to left field. Chris coming on, dives. He made the catch! He made the catch! If he doesn't make that catch and the ball gets by him, the Blue Jays tie the game. What a play by Coco! And no one manipulates a bullpen better than Terry Francona. Slider check swing, he went around. Miller gets another strikeout. Swing and a miss. Struck him out on the slider. And one of the great postseason stories of all time unfolding here tonight in Toronto with what this Indians pitching staff is about to accomplish. The pitch. Swung on, bank back up the middle, behind second, backhanded by Kipnis, throw to first, ball game! He got him on a great play, ranging far to his right with a backhand in back of second and a tremendous throw to first. And the Indians have beaten the Blue Jays again in the most improbable scenario you've ever envisioned in postseason play.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I think it is all of those things. It really is one of the great stories in postseason history that's underway, and game number four is underway as well from the Rogers Center. We'll see where it goes, the Indians and Blue Jays, game number four. We're going to shift gears a bit right now, because I'm going to assume if you're interested in baseball, you're probably watching or listening to baseball right now. We tried to set it up for you in hour number one prior to the first pitch of the game, which, of course, is going on right now in the ALCS. But we'll shift gears now as we continue until 5 o'clock in drive time right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks again to Matt Lodi for breaking it down with us from the Cleveland perspective out there. Getting ready for hopefully what is the first World Series appearance for that franchise since 1997. Joe Haas of Delta was our winner. He is going to go to the Glass Bowl and watch some high school football with St. Francis of Fremont Ross on Friday night. Congratulations. I got a couple of other cool things to give away or to qualify you for so that you could potentially claim a prize before we are done this afternoon. By the way, speaking of what else is coming up this afternoon, the battle for I-75 or the I-75 rivalry, if you will, which was renewed on Saturday and won by the Toledo Rockets, 42-35, a really amazing game. BG gave the Rockets all they wanted and then some for a team that is 6-1 now, or no, 5-1, beg your pardon, in the Rockets. And then, of course, the Falcons, who are 1-6. It was a lot better game than a lot of people really thought it would be. We're going to talk about that game and about what's coming up next for the BG Falcons with head coach Mike Jinks. He's going to join us after the bottom of the hour at about 4:35. He'll have a weekly conversation that he has with Jim Cushlin, and we're looking forward to seeing what he says about the I-75 rivalry, his first taste of that, as well as the game coming up on Saturday against Miami of Ohio. If you're scoring or wondering, by the way, the Rockets next up on Saturday is Central Michigan, also home game at the Glass Bowl. So I wanted to bring up a couple of other things as we continue this afternoon that are non-baseball related. Cushlin, did you watch the hit or see it in replay mode? The hit that was put on the Browns' Jordan Poyer on a punt return in the second quarter of the game on Sunday against the Titans, the Tennessee Titans.
I'll admit I missed that one.
Safety Jordan Poyer. It's been one of the big stories in the NFL, actually, because Jordan Poyer was just flat out destroyed. And I mean destroyed. And he went to the hospital actually immediately after that game, left the game and was put into the concussion protocol at the very beginning, or at least he was being evaluated to see if he had to go into the protocol. But they couldn't really continue that evaluation because they had to get him to the hospital because it turns out he has a lacerated kidney. Pretty big deal. He was absolutely blasted by Titans running back Antonio Andrews on a special teams play on a punt return. What happened was, the Browns punted, beg your pardon, and the Titans were returning the punt, and Jordan Poyer was in coverage. And what happened on this play, and anybody who saw the game knows what I'm talking about, what happened on this play was that Poyer was in hot pursuit, probably about 3 yards away from the Titan punt returner. And obviously a very serious threat to tackle the runner, to tackle the punt return. Seeing that, Titans running back Antonio Andrews did what he is paid to do. He blocked for his punt returner, and he blocked Jordan Poyer. But he did it in a very, very vicious way because Poyer was jacked up. Now, mind you, there used to be an NFL Films video series called, for goodness sakes, what did they call it? They sold them. It was a compilation of the NFL's hardest hits. I'm trying to remember what they called the series. I can't recall it now. I apologize. But then there was also an ESPN feature, if you recall, not too terribly long ago, in which on SportsCenter every Sunday night or early in the work week after Sunday's games, they did a feature called Jacked Up, in which they showed the highlights of the hardest hits of the weekend, guys getting jacked up, right? This was a jacked up hit. This would have made every highlight video, the NFL's NFL Films video series, and much, much more. I think it was called Crunch Course. Now I remember, NFL Crunch Course. That's what the video series, back on actual VHS videotape back in the day. But it would have been called Crunch Course, and this would have made that, no question about it. Now, what Andrews did was 100% legal in the actual literal definition of the word legal in terms of NFL football. His head was in front of Jordan Poyer. Jordan Poyer was a material part of the play, about 3 yards away from the returner and in full pursuit trying to tackle the punt returner. So it wasn't like it was a hit 25 yards away and he was not part of the play and was thus an unnecessary strike of a defenseless player. But Andrews hit him so hard as Poyer was in pursuit and Poyer was not looking, because he was looking where? Where would you be looking if you're trying to tackle somebody? He was looking at the returner. Andrews blocked him, and he hit him in the chest. His shoulder was to Poyer's chest, and he knocked him about 5 yards off of his feet into the air and back onto the ground. He stayed down for a while, got up to his knees, and stayed down even longer. He was clearly hurt. He was removed from the game, as I said. He was unable to go into the concussion protocol to be evaluated for that because of the kidney laceration. The flag came out on that play because, as the official said, it was a blindside hit because Poyer's eyes weren't on the blocker. Poyer's eyes were on the ball carrier. That is one of the biggest bullcrap rules or explanations I have ever heard. Browns fans were apoplectic about what a dirty hit that was. That was Hines Ward or James Harrison-esque, you know, of the hated Steelers. They were angry. I told Browns fans to shut up, and I say it again now. That was an NFL football block. It wasn't cheap. It wasn't behind. It wasn't a clip. It wasn't below the waist. It didn't take out knees. It was above the waist, head in front, shoulder to chest, and it was a blow-up. What the NFL essentially is ruling on a play like that, and by the way, not only was it a 15-yard penalty on Andrews, it's also going to lead to about a $25,000 fine for this special teams running back, Antonio Andrews of the Titans. All because what the NFL should really call this, he hit him too hard. I know that the NFL has its problems with safety concerns. I know that they've been sued by so many former players. I know that there is a reputation that they've developed within a lot of families, particularly nervous moms, about the game being too violent. And I know they're trying to watch out for that. But if you are telling players they can't block other block defenders who are literally within 2 or 3 yards of the ball carrier and pursuing fast, closing fast, and about to make a tackle, that you can't block them unless they're looking at you, then you have eliminated football. You have crossed over into flag or touch or whatever it is that you want. Because essentially, Poirier got knocked from the game and into the hospital on a legal hit that they are just deciding was too hard. Next time, just lean on him. Because he wasn't looking, his eyes were on the ball carrier, not on you. It was not a cheap shot. It was a legal hit. Now, I say all of that, knowing that many, many Cleveland Browns fans disagree with me, and I saw a lot of comments on message boards talking about how cheap it was, and I tell them all again, if you don't want to listen to me, listen to the head coach of the Cleveland Browns, Hugh Jackson, who said absolutely that that was a hit that should be allowed in the National Football League. Jackson said, as far as Jordan Poyer's safety, as far as his condition, that, quote, "I know he wants to be back with his teammates battling with those guys like most of our players do. They feel like when they're not around these guys, they're letting them down. He's not. He took a major hit. Obviously, that's going to take some time for him to heal from," end quote. And that's fair. Some of his teammates have expressed support and concern for him as well. As far as the performance goes, as far as the team goes, Poirier was one of a three-man rotation at safety. Second-year player Ibrahim Campbell and rookie fourth-rounder Derek Kindred joined him in rotating there, so he's going to be out for a while with that lacerated kidney. But was it anything illegal? If they don't want to listen to me or anybody else who actually likes NFL football and believes in hitting and blocking and tackling and doing so hard, here's Hugh Jackson. Quote, "It's football. You have an assignment. You have a guy to block, and the guy's clearly in your sights. I don't think the player was intentionally trying to hurt him. I think he was trying to do his job, which was block him. And he did." End quote. That's Hugh Jackson, who doesn't think what Antonio Andrews did was violent, or excuse me, was illegal. It wasn't blindsided. It didn't deserve a 15-yard penalty, and it certainly doesn't deserve what's certain to be about a $25,000 fine. Do we want the NFL to be so watered down, to be so soft, out of concern for the safety of players, that we take blocking and tackling in a way that we have always played it out of the game? I know that's why they've messed with the kickoff line. They're trying to kick off. You know the story now. They're trying to they initially moved the kickoff up 5 yards so that there would be more touchback, so you don't have a bunch of those high-speed collisions on kick returns. Now, of course, you see too many players not wanting to do that, or too many kickers, I should say, short kicking to make sure the ball stays in play so that they can pin them back deeper, because now they're giving them the 25-yard line on a touchback instead of the 20 and blah, blah, blah. They're screwing around with all kinds of things to cut down on injuries, and in the process, they're taking the game away from itself. What I saw on Sunday in that game, and this is a guy, again, I'm a Browns guy. I'm not a Titans guy by any means, but I'm defending the Titans player here because I'm defending the game of football. I sit here always, over and over and over again, finding myself on the defensive saying, what are they expecting these guys to do? Not to borrow Jack Lambert's old line about putting skirts on quarterbacks, but seriously, what is it that they're trying to accomplish here? If they either want the game to be played in a physical way, or they want to take that away and turn it into flag or some variation of what used to be tackle football. And you know what? You can't have it both ways. Just understand this. If they continue to flag guys and fine guys for legal blocks above the waist, in front, head in front, not from behind, not from the side, if they continue to flag guys for that simply because the other player wasn't aware, because the other player didn't have his head on a swivel, as we teach our kids that we coach playing football, to have your head on a swivel, to look around and see where danger lies, see where other players are, know what threats there might be to you. If they really want to do that, then be prepared for the consequences, which is the ratings, which are already dropping precipitously in the National Football League this year. Be prepared for those ratings to plummet even further as people decide they don't want to watch two hand pushes to the chest of a player or the side of a player, that they want hitting, that guys wear shoulder pads and helmets for a reason, not for decoration, not because they look cool, which they do, but because they are supposed to be used to protect somebody from being struck and, of course, used to strike with. That is exactly what the name of the game is, and I've had just about enough of babying these guys. God bless Jordan Poyer. I hope he has a wonderfully quick recovery from his injury. Hopefully the lacerated kidney is something that can be taken care of safely, and it's 100% recovery. But guess what? This is football. And he was hit by a football player making a football play. And we have to stop the babying of these guys if we want the league to remain what it's always been.
And that's a good call, Bob. And while you were talking about that, I had a chance to take a look at it, to finally get a good look at it. Because I've been watching, honestly, it's mostly been for purposes of being on this show. I've been watching Brown stuff at times. If I wasn't here, I probably wouldn't this season. But I did get a look at that. And you're right. There's nothing illegal about the hit. Sometimes really bad things happen on football hits. That's part of the game, for goodness sake, you know, as you're saying. And so that the fact that there's some out there that are whining about it, they're in the wrong here. It was a legal hit. I see nothing wrong with it as I take a look at it now. It's just he got hit in the wrong place, and you wish him, you know, a speedy recovery. And you're right. If they keep doing these kinds of things, which they are, as we know, and that's a great point, because for those who hadn't, you know, noticed that or heard this one, yes, what Bob just said a few minutes ago is true. Look it up, people. Ratings are noticeably down in the National Football League this year. They are. And this is probably one of the reasons, this kind of stuff is probably one of the reasons why that is the case. And for Poyer, you do hope he eventually recovers fine from this. I mean, obviously, what he's now dealing with is no laughing matter, but there wasn't anything illegal about that hit. It was a hard hit. And yeah, I question if there even should have been a flag thrown for that kind of thing. We got to remember, you know, these things happen, and we shouldn't be doing the overreacting of which I keep interpreting to this day of that kickoff rule. That is simply overreacting because of the reasons that the NFL aside. Sure, those things happen every once in a while, but it changes how certain games get played. If guys are just booting it out of the end zone and taking the touchback, which is now at the 25, of course, not the 20,
right?
Because of that. So at some point, they gotta stop trying to do this. I mean, and it's not just these kind of things, as we talked about, Bob. I think it was last Monday. Yeah, it was last Monday when I was out at Yark, because I was talking to you there when we were bringing this up. And
right,
we were talking about, once again, guys wearing stuff on their cleats, and the NFL's, you know, trying to prevent that truly controversial thing But the side effect is it's going to make them automatically, without questioning or looking at it at all, eliminating things that are really not bad and should be encouraged, I dare say, on some levels.
Yeah,
on some
again, of this. You know, this guy didn't do anything with an intent to injure. This guy did not hit him in the back. He did not take out his knees. He did not go helmet to helmet.
Exactly.
He put a shoulder in a guy's chest, and that's it.
It happens. I was taught to hit that way.
That's exactly
in a way,
right.
You it's get just low, you don't, hard, you don't put him, your right. head straight down, but you know, you hit with that shoulder and come from below, especially if you're a small guy like me. My goodness, that's how I was taught to hit.
Exactly right. And that's what happened in this case. We'll have more on that, obviously, I think, tomorrow. But we've got to take a time out now because we're going to get into college football with BG coach Mike Jinks coming up next. We'll check in with the coach about their loss to Toledo in the I-75 battle on Saturday and as they look ahead to Miami coming up this week. But before we do that, as long as we're on college football, let's get another qualifier for the grand prize, the College Football National Championship Flyaway on January 9th in Tampa. Trip for two down to Tampa with round-trip airfare, four-night hotel stay, two upper-level tickets to the game, rental car with parking, and a tour of the Yuengling Brewery in Tampa, Florida. That's a $5,000 prize package. The runner-up, by the way, if you don't win that prize, you could win a pair of tickets and a trip, a limo trip. That's right, limousine service to Columbus for Ohio State in Michigan on November 26th. Third place is a prize package from Yuengling. All you got to do to qualify is be the eighth caller right now to 866-240. I'm sorry, the eighth caller. Right now, to qualify, eighth caller now, to 866-240-1065, and we will set you up with that. If you don't qualify on the radio, you can qualify online once a day at 1065theticket.com. Good luck from Yuengling Lager, York Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram, Country Heart Fireplaces and Stoves, Allegiant Air at Toledo Express Airport, Toledo Image Limousine, and, of course, Toledo's ESPN 1065 The Ticket. So we'll qualify here coming up in just a minute. Also, in just a few minutes, after our bottom of the hour Sports Center, college football talk with Mike Jinks, the head coach of Bowling Green, coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
By The Ticket.
And welcome back into the extravaganza. Jim Cushlin here hanging with you on this Tuesday, taking a little break from some of the baseball talk. We got some college football to discuss. Another classic in the battle of I-75 saw Toledo outlast the Bowling Green Falcons 42-35. Falcons had this tied in the last few minutes of this game. And even with the defeat, a nice rebound game, I thought, in this battle of I-75 rivalry. And help us talk all things Bowling Green football, we welcome in the head coach of the Falcons. He is Mike Jinks. Hi, Coach. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Jim. How are you?
Not too bad. And I know it was a loss to move you guys to 1-6, but boy, we saw again on Saturday why in rivalry games you could just throw all sorts of records and everything just completely out the window. This was a wonderfully entertaining back-and-forth game. You guys got a couple of touchdowns in the fourth that ended up tying this game before falling in the end. Talk to me about the resiliency of your guys in this one.
Well, you know, they've had that never-die attitude for the last few weeks now. You know, they believe in one another. I think they believe in us as a coaching staff. And, you know, we've got this 1-6 record, but it's been well documented. I've loved coaching this football team. We're playing as a family, and we'll continue to fight throughout the rest of the season.
And you guys got production, you know, from all over the place. And again, as I'm sure I've said already, and we'll say probably a few more times in the course of this interview, this is why you throw all the records out during rivalry games. James Morgan, awesome day for him. Fred Coppett gets over 100 yards. You guys had a clicking on offense, and it was a nice thing to see.
Yeah, you know, we're improving, Jim. We're improving. You know, after the game, I said it, not trying to be disrespectful by any means, but just really don't believe in moral victory. I'm just not a big believer in it. The fact of the matter is you know, we're not where we want to be right now. We understand that as a football team, we're going to continue to grind. We're going to continue to push. And, you know, we're going to start stacking good games on top of each other.
And that's obviously, you know, well said, Coach, and so very true. You know, we're not in this business, obviously, for moral victories, but at the same token, you know, and you said it all year, this team, they work hard, they're not quitting on themselves, and that's the kind of thing you want to see, and it really, I thought, both sides of the football, even with the Rockets putting up 42, because that's a high-powered offensive team, you know, you guys were in this throughout the whole thing, and again, I know there's no moral victories, but it's got to be, to a small degree, nice confirmation that I know I still have a good crop of players here.
No doubt. You know, we're playing a lot of young kids right now, but they're talented. They're talented, and I think you're starting to see some of these guys relax and starting to see some of their skill sets. You know, the thing that you know, and yeah, there were positives, Jim. You know that. Probably the thing that you know, I took out of the most is it's always nice to know that you got a trigger man back there that has a mentality, that gunslinger mentality, and you're never out of a ball game. He's done it 3 weeks in a row. Now, what we've got to do, we've got to find a way to calm ourselves down in that second and third quarter and play a little bit more consistent football. You know, and one of the things that he and I talked about, he being James Morgan, all the last couple of days, we went back to look at that second series in the third quarter. We get it's 21-27, Toledo's got the lead, and we get an interception. Big play by our defense at midfield. You know, and we leave three throws on the board, I mean, that he hits on a regular basis. And both of them had a chance to score for touchdowns, and we missed them. And we weren't even close on the throws. So, he's going to be a special player. He can make some throws, as I said, a lot of people in this country really can't make. We just got to, you know, we just consistent improvement, continue to get better.
And with that, you know, with that being said, you know, because we've seen that over the course of these last couple of weeks as well, the improvement that's ongoing with Morgan, 335, five touchdowns, did have the one pick, you know, an overall outstanding game. To know that he's a freshman and to know that you do indeed have a special talent there, I mean, general rule, I mean, he's a freshman. He's only going to get better.
Yeah, I think we see that. Our team sees it. I mean, there's an energy about us. You know, really, you know, there was a point in that fourth quarter, the punt, the fake punt, Joe, you know, pulling out, you know, that was an amazing play by that kid. I just saw a change in our football team. I saw a change in their eye. You know, we got that ball back and they weren't going to be denied. They weren't going to be stopped, you know, and we got into a rhythm and, I think that's going to go a long way for us this season.
Talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza. 42-35, the Rockets getting the victory in the Battle of I-75 back on Saturday, but it was a darn entertaining football game. And another thing that's jumping out at me, coach, for the most part, there was one in the early fourth quarter where you guys did get a touchdown on a 51, one of five, of course, from Morgan. This was a 57-yard pass, but the rest I'm seeing, you know, 20-18, which means you were getting sustained longer drives that put right. Points on the board.
Right. We're, you know, like I said, we're improving. I think Coach Campbell probably said it best. And you know, and again, let me be sure I do this. He's a class guy, and they've got a great football team. We wish them the best of luck the rest of this year. But I think we've kind of found our identity a little bit offensively of who we want to be or what this group can do well and starting to hone on in it a little bit. And you're starting to see it click. You know, one of the things that I was most proud of, there's about three or four times in that ball game where I've called four times to take a shot, and James recognizes the defense, recognizes the secondary and what's going on, checks out and gets us into a run in a positive place. So we start to do those kind of things. We'll continue. I think you'll like what you see.
Now, after scoring three touchdowns in the fourth quarter with basically 3 minutes to go, you now have this game tied at 35. And you're on the road, of course. This is road year in the I-75 rivalry at the Glass Bowl. Walk me through, though, that final defensive sequence that led to a another one of those. And Rocket fans are familiar with this, Kareem Hunt touchdowns. You had them where it was tied very, very late. Walk me through defensively what happened there.
You know, it's, you know, really the first thing was, you know, in my head, I was really contemplating whether to go for two or not. And really, everybody had to talk me out of it a little bit. It was just too much time left, you know, too much time left. And our defense, you know, they'd had seven three and outs or what have you throughout that ball game, times that we stopped and might necessarily three and out. So felt like, you know, that we get a stop, we can go back, you know, felt like we were in a groove offensively, plenty of time for us to go back, kick a field goal, win the ball game. And then, you know, they pound the ball a little bit to us, and then they hit the big pass play. Probably the biggest play, it was a face mask. I think Trent Green, there's a play we had him stopped on third down that would have forced the field goal with about a minute and 10 left to go, which would have given us plenty of time to, uh, you know, to have the ball last go down, have a chance to win it. And that was probably the critical play of the drive.
We're talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here, getting your college football report and update here on the Extravaganza. Jim Cushlin here. It was 42-35, Rockets over the Falcons in the Battle of I-75 at the Glass Bowl back on Saturday. And again, I know you said a few minutes ago, Coach, you know, you're not looking for moral victories. You know, no one really technically is, but with the way this game played out, even in defeat, what are a few positives you could take away from this one?
Well, number one is we got a group that understands what it means to play 60 minutes. And that's been a process. We'd have played with that same mentality. You know, earlier in the season, we might not have had those same outcomes. You know, one of the things that stuck out to me in this ball game, and a group that I've been really hard on and deservingly so, is the receiving core. And I don't know that there was a drop ball in this ball game. And that's the difference. You know, when we're making the, you know, not the special plays, you know, we made a few of those, but when you're making the routine plays, you give yourself an opportunity to make that special big play. So, you know, hopefully, that's what you'll see moving forward.
Talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza on the Ticket. Coming up next, your final Saturday game, Coach, before we hit the Maction in the weekday games in November. Back at the Doit on Saturday, 11 a.m., by the way, the pregame time for the high noon kickoff. You can hear that game over on our sister station, Talk Radio 100.7. You get Miami, a Miami team that's having some of the same issues that you are. They're coming in at 1-6 as well. Give me some keys of this game, what Miami looks to do, because despite their 1-6 record and recent struggles in recent years, this is still a proud program, just like the Falcons are. And so talk to me about what you're planning to do to stop the Miami squad in this one coming up on Saturday.
Well, offensively, we've got to establish a run game. I think everything that we're trying to do at this point in, with our offense and system, you know, builds around that. You know, right now I think they're second or third in the conference in pass defense. They've got some guys back there on the back end that can do some things. So, we got to get that extra guy, into the box to create some one-on-ones and hopefully hit some big plays. And then, defensively, we're going to have to be physical and tackle because, they're going to come right at you a little bit. And, we're going to have to, you know, have the same mindset, that we did going into last week's ball game. You know, I was asked if I thought there was going to be a letdown. No, I think there'll be just even greater sense of urgency because it's a one game playoff right now, Jim. It's a one game playoff right now. And it's win one game and survive to get to where we want to go.
Good point, Coach. It'll be the Bowling Green Falcons taking on Miami. Both teams coming in 1-6. BG 0-3 in MAC play. Miami is 1-2. So that should be an interesting affair coming up on Saturday. It'll be at the Doit, 11 a.m. pregame time for the high noon kickoff. Again, as I mentioned, final Saturday game before the Maction begins in the weekday games. After this one on Saturday, the Falcons will not play again until Tuesday, November 1st at Northern Illinois to get those games underway. It'll be an interesting one coming up at the Doit on Saturday. Coach, we always appreciate the time, always appreciate the insight, love talking to you, and hopefully we're talking about a Bowling Green Falcons win. We'll reconvene next week, Coach.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
That is head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Mike Jinks, joining us here on the Extravaganza. And you know, this is why. I remember back on Friday, I was subbing for Mike Miller on drive time, as is usually the case on Thursdays and or Fridays with his hockey assignments, and I was stunned when I was going through prepping for some of the picks, and I first noticed that, wow, this just shows you where these two teams are right now, because Toledo was favored by 31 points in that game. I don't think I can ever recall, and maybe some older Toledo or Bowling Green fans out there can let me know if I'm wrong out there, but I highly doubt there's ever been a Toledo BG football game with a point spread as much as that, and that's more of a testament to where both teams are right now this season. But man, you want that textbook cliche of throw those things out the window when you get into a rivalry game. Boy, Saturday's game was it. Falcons had multiple chances to win it, including near the end, where they tied the game. game with 3 minutes left, and then Toledo goes on that last drive, capped by Kareem Hunt's only touchdown, by the way, of the game. And credit to the Falcons, they kept him under 100 yards rushing. It was actually Terry Swanson who did more of the rushing damage than Kareem Hunt in this one. And Coach said it just there a little bit ago. You know, guys executed even more so than normal. There weren't drop passes and things like that. And that even for a team that's struggling like the Falcons, it just shows you that in the right scenario, you know, throw records out for rivalry game and you fully execute your game plan and don't make any real mistakes, even any little ones. And you're going to be in a football game against a really solid team that nobody has been able to figure out how to stop, not even in their one loss for Toledo at BYU, because they still put up 50-some-odd points in that game. So no one's really been able to stop this Rockets offense all season. And it's not that we were expecting the Falcons to, like, go up there and allow only 10 points, but for them to come back, execute an offense the way they did, you know, he's right. There are no moral victories, especially for a team that literally now has to win out just to be bowl eligible. So I'll go ahead and say it right now. Sorry, Falcon fans. I don't think there's a MAC championship game or a bowl game in the near future for 2016. That's just the way it is. When you're at a point in mid-late October, and you have to win out just to be bowl eligible, it's probably not going to go down that way. But there are certainly some positives you can absolutely take if you're the Falcons from that game. Into a game coming up on Saturday where they're going to play a Miami team that, like Bowling Green, proud program that in recent years, this is unlike the Falcons because, of course, the Falcons have been to multiple MAC championship games with a MAC championship in the very, very recent past, like, oh, I don't know, last year, for example. But Miami's been struggling for a few years now, and both 1-6, you get it back at the Deut, and at this point, you know, as Coach said, it's a one-game playoff. That's the only way, if you're the Falcons, you could treat this thing. You still want to play hard. You still want to go out there and try to win every game you can. You know, deep down, they still want to be bowl eligible if they can get there, and it's going to take a one-game-at-a-time approach. And they got a couple of halfway decent opponents, at least in terms of what they're doing this year, 1-6 Miami at the Deut, then the first Maction game coming up on Tuesday, November 1st. Next week is essentially the bye week to, of course, set the calendar up for that. And that's at Northern Illinois, a team that, despite their success in this conference in recent years, they're just not playing good football this year. That was inevitable that eventually there'd be a downturn, especially at this level. There always is. And Northern's coming into this game, into their game this weekend, 1-6. So a couple of teams who've been struggling during this season, and that's what's up next for the Falcons. And yeah, the template for what they did in Toledo, if they repeat that template, the Falcons will win both against Miami and Northern Illinois. They showed me enough anyway to put up those kind of numbers against the Toledo Rockets team. And we'll talk later in the week with Jason Candle about it. I'm sure he's going to have a few things to say on his defense for allowing 35 points to a Falcons team that, quite frankly, has struggled a lot. But, you know, at the same time, this is the kind of game where even in defeat, you can absolutely take some positives, and if you can execute game plans and things of that nature, you'll be able to at worst even split, if not take the next two, and that'll just get the ball rolling in the right direction. Even if at the end of the day, this is a lost kind of season with no bowl game appearance, you know, it's still, you want to finish strong. You want to have these guys out there. And Coach, of course, because of the struggles, has been playing with a lot of the younger guys. That's why you see James Morgan out there, for most blatant example, the freshman, true freshman at quarterback. And he's improving every week. And to a small degree, they may very well have something special. If he's doing this as a freshman, imagine what he'll be doing as a sophomore or even a junior. So the Falcons got some things. And you want to be able to get those guys out there, get them more and more experience every week, and try and finish strong, because if you can finish strong, that puts a good vibe in everyone's mind going into next season. So the Falcons fall at Toledo, which was kind of expected. What was not expected was the back and forth nature of this football game that took a final drive in the final minute for the Rockets just to end up with the win. And up next for the Bowling Green Falcons, back at the Deut, they'll take on Miami, the Redhawks, coming up on Saturday. That's a noon kickoff and an 11 a.m. pregame time. You'll hear it on our sister station, Talk Radio 100.7. Hey, that's going to do it for this edition of the Extravaganza here on this Tuesday. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Mike Miller, Drive Time, coming up next, and then a little bit later on this evening, it'll be the high school Football Forum. We're coming up week nine. It's only 2 weeks left in the high school regular season before the playoffs get underway. And Bill Clark and the crew, as always, joined by us coaches and a couple players from a couple of teams. It'll be Greg Dempsey and those Central Catholic Fighting Irish, number one in Division III, and of course still undefeated. They'll be on hand at the Forum. And then Rob Garber of the Woodward Polar Bears. They're leading the City League right now. Just on the outside looking in playoff-wise, that happens with the City League, but they are having an outstanding season for a program that's kind of been down in recent times. So Rob Garber and the Woodward Polar Bears will also join Bill Clark and the crew for the High School Football Forum. That is at 7 o'clock tonight here on the Ticket. As soon as that's done, we'll take you to Dodger Stadium. Dodgers, Cubs, Game 3 of the National League Championship Series, courtesy of ESPN Radio. That's on the way later tonight. So Mike Miller coming up next on Drive Time. Stick around for that. High School Football Forum and some baseball a little later. We'll reconvene to talk about it all. And maybe, maybe, just maybe, a Cleveland Indians pennant. Oh, my. I'm just, I'm looking so forward to that possibility. That could be as early as tonight and then recapping tomorrow's show. So lots ahead. Enjoy the baseball. Enjoy the high school football talk. Mike Miller on Drive Time coming up next. We'll talk to you tomorrow.